You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Kick-Ass News is brought to you by Capella University. Are you considering a doctorate to help you lead at the top of your field and contribute to your profession in more meaningful ways? Capella University can help. With flexible online degree programs and scholarship opportunities for select programs, Capella can help support your goals from beginning to end. Learn more at capella.edu/kick. And now, on with the show. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. In 2017, writer, director, producer, and supermom Jeannie Gaffigan's life came crashing to a halt when she was diagnosed with a life-threatening brain tumor. The mother of five kids, six if you include her husband, comedian Jim Gaffigan, she sat in the neurosurgery department in star-covered sweatpants and wondered, "Am I going to die?" Thankfully, Jeannie and her family were able to survive their time of crisis, and now she writes with humor and heart about the pear-sized brain tumor she had removed, the toll it took on her enormous family, and the priceless lessons she learned along the way. Her book is called When Life Gives You Pears: The Healing Power of Family, Faith, and Funny People. And today, Jeannie Gaffigan joins me on the show to talk about it. She shares how she went from a perfectly normal life to being rushed into surgery over the course of an Easter weekend, why things got worse just when she thought she was in the clear, and how she learned that laughter truly is the best medicine. Then she reveals how she and Jim write comedy together, talks about Jim's surprising swagger when he first began romancing her, and how she finally knew that he was the one. She also says that she and Jim decided to end the Jim Gaffigan show after only two seasons because they wanted to spend more time with their real family instead of their TV family, and she describes how her medical scare brought her family even closer and taught her to appreciate the small moments in life. Coming up with Jeannie Gaffigan in just a moment. Jeannie Gaffigan is a director, producer, and comedy writer. She co-wrote seven comedy specials with her husband, Jim Gaffigan, the last four of which received Grammy nominations, and she collaborated with Jim on the two New York Times bestsellers Dad is Fat and Food, A Love Story. Jeannie was also the head writer and executive producer of the critically acclaimed The Jim Gaffigan Show, which was loosely based on their family. Oh, and she also grew a tumor on her brainstem, roughly the size of a pear. Now she writes about the experience in a new memoir titled When Life Gives You Pears: The Healing Power of Family, Faith, and Funny People. Jeannie Gaffigan, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, Ben.
Well, Jeannie, I've had your husband Jim on a couple of times, and it's just so great to finally have you on because Jim's family life is so essential to his act. I'm excited to get the other half of the dynamic duo here. Let's be honest, you never really know about a family until you get the woman's perspective, do you?
Well, I'm hoping that some of my perspective might shine through a little bit in the writing. Mm-hmm. But I think that I am kind of like someone who's used to being behind the scenes. So it's pretty ironic that it took a medical crisis to get me out of the shadows.
Yeah. You've written for Jim and in Jim's voice for so many years. What was it like to finally get to write for and as yourself in this book?
Well, it was a very new experience for me, but it was just kind of something that was so personal. I couldn't be like, you know, Jim, the time that you had a brain tumor, how did you feel? But at the same time, I mean, everything we do it together. Mm-hmm. It just this time was really I had to kind of put together for myself the chronology of what happened, because it just happened so fast. And the next thing I knew, you know, I had people approaching me wanting to hear the story. And I was like, I don't even remember what happened. And so it was important for me, both from a therapeutic, like a coping strategy, and just also to make sense of my life, to be able to like express myself in this way.
Let me ask you this, Jeannie. When you're writing for Jim's stand-up specials or co-writing a book like Dad is Fat, how do you write in Jim's voice? Is it just that you've been around each other for so long and have so many of the same shared experiences that it sort of becomes innate, or what?
During the Jim Gaffigan show, as opposed to when I've been, you know, in the background producing the specials and like tagging Jim's lines and writing in Jim's point of view, for instance, in Dad is Fat, it's not my perspective, but I collaborated heavily on that book as Jim. You know, I was like, and then you would do this or you think this because I understand your voice because we've been together for so long. In the show, there was a character named Jeannie Gaffigan, and there was the female perspective. So we did have that sort of, you know, I had an outlet before to have it to present the Jeannie Gaffigan point of view with the you know, sort of the foil to Jim's kind of, you know, overeating and laziness. And I was the kind of the type A who was, you know, who was more, you know, food conscious and mindful about things. And so that's a good dynamic. But in this sense, this was just me.
Yeah. And in the book, you actually say that you were initially hesitant to marry Jim for fear that you would lose your own identity and just be subsumed into his career. From what I can tell, that hasn't really been the case. You two seem to have a terrific working relationship and you've sort of risen together.
I mean, I think that the story of our partnership is really, you know, a whole another story. I mean, there could be a whole book about the, you know, the ups and downs of being, you know, having a huge family and being separated from each other for extended periods of time when I was, and I had the two babies, and all of a sudden I wasn't traveling with Jim anymore, and I had to take more of a, you know, a remote producer role in a lot of the collaboration. But this relationship started as an artistic collaboration, even when we were in two different worlds. So we always collaborated. And I think that our work ethic, even though they were towards different things, was something that, like, we saw in each other. And we understood that the work didn't have to be something that, like, drove a wedge between our relationship, that it would be something that we could share in a relationship, which is very unique. The kind of difficulty in the beginning in the collaboration is that Jim was already writing very tight comedy, and he had his comic point of view pretty developed. And I never was like, I want in on the comedy writing. It just sort of happened because he was, and this is going to date, you know, us and how long ago this was. But I remember one day he came in to my apartment. I was, my sister was my roommate, and he came over and he said, you know, he had a CD in his hand, and he was like, Rich Voss produced his own CD. He put out his own CD, and he's like, I want to do this too, because this is so cool that people are putting out their own CDs and selling them after shows. So this is like, that's how long ago it was.
This must have been
like
in the
2000,
90s, huh?
2001. Yeah.
Okay.
Yes. It was about 2000. And because I met Jim around, I didn't meet Jim in the 90s. I met him in 2000, okay, in the millennial year. So I said, well, I think I could probably figure that out. So I started to go to his sets with him, and he would run his like 10, 15 minute set at like several different clubs. And as I started to put together the kind of set list for the CD that I was producing, I started kind of putting some input to him saying, you know, when you, I didn't get the manatee joke, what didn't sound like as fresh or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I'd say, you know, kind of come up with it. There was a show where you kind of like came up with it in the middle, you know, and I started collaborating that way. He wasn't like, can you write some jokes for me ever? He was very close to the vest. And he was like, yeah, that's, I'll take that with a grain of salt. Thanks a lot. But when I was kind of directing it, that's how the door kind of opened for us to start collaborating. And over the years, it just became co-writing.
Yeah, because you had been an actress, but you weren't really part of the whole New York stand-up world.
No.
And then you started writing comedy for him. When did it click with you that you kind of realized, hey, I'm pretty funny, I can do this?
Well, you know, I don't know if it has clicked yet with me because he's a comic genius. I really believe that. But just like I learned a lot from Jim because my comedy writing, and also I was comedy writing because I wrote for a sketch group. I just didn't write stand-up. Okay. But it's a completely different art form, and I'm more of a storyteller. Like my kind of skill in comedy writing is in like long-form stories. And Jim is a wordsmith. So he's economy of words. So he has kind of these big ideas, and he has he's a wordsmith, if that's the best way I can put it. So he taught me a lot about comedy writing, about cutting out some of the fat. So basically in my memoir, that's me. You know, I'm a storyteller. I go, right. I write a lot.
Right. And your memoir is very funny. I think you sell yourself short if you say that you don't think that you're quite as funny as you ought to be.
Well, I mean, I'm just saying that there's stand-up comedy is a certain type of writing, and
right.
it's different than a
For
memoir.
Sure.
You know, it's like a comedy. And I mean, I know that's really obvious, but I'm just saying Jim has a very tight skill as a stand-up comedy writer, and he taught me how to write stand-up comedy.
Mm-hmm.
Like I might have a witty way of expressing myself, but he has the kind of cadence. He's very skilled at the setup, punchline, callback. Like he just has a very precise rhythm to his joke telling.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm more of a storyteller. So that's, but then we can collaborate and I can add details to his, his point of view. And he can add, he can make my rambling more concise.
Yeah.
So it's a pretty cool partnership.
Another aspect that I found interesting in this book is the love story between you and Jim. I mean, I had no idea that Jim had this kind of swagger. He's surprisingly smooth, dare I say romantic, huh? Tell us about how y'all met.
I mean, it was really surprising. It was really surprising because he just had this confidence that he would call me up and be like, hi, it's your new boyfriend. And I'm like, what? What are you talking about? What do you mean my new boyfriend? But in a way, I kind of liked it, the way that he was just kind of like, you know, you and I are probably going to get married someday. It's like I never, he had just so much confidence. Like he just didn't.
Yeah. Didn't he say that the first time you guys met?
First time we met. And I was yelling at him, too. I was telling him he's an egomaniac because he was like, where do I know you from? And I was like, you've met me like six times. But I mean, it was in passing. But still, you still remember somebody. I mean, for God's sake. And I thought that he was trying to be like arrogant, like, oh, you're so forgettable. And I was like, really? And I was like, you're really arrogant. And he was like, we're probably going to get married. Like, literally, that was our first meeting. Our first real conversation was him telling me we're going to get married and me telling him to, F off.
So when did it finally sink in with you that, yes, this was the guy that we were meant to be? Where was there a moment?
There was a moment. There was a moment. I actually write about it in the book. And actually, that love story, that little interlude in the book, was not part of the book. That was an essay that I wrote. And I just kind of one day I stuck it in my manuscript and sent it to my editor. And she was like, oh, this is interesting. This is kind of off the story. It's, you know, it's almost like the prelude. And I was like, yeah, but I think that maybe it's the interlude. You know, it was just a weird place to put it. But so the moment was it probably should have been right away. Like, it probably should have been the first date, like the lunch that we had, where I was fighting against liking him so much and he was fighting against liking me so much. We probably should have listened to that, like, little inner voice saying, you know, this is probably the perfect match. And then we went through, like, a period of 2 years where we, like, were, like, on and off and, you know, is this going to work and how could it work and all this stuff. But essentially, my sister, who was my roommate, had, like, a talk with me. And she was like, what is going on? Like, why don't – like, basically, Jim sat her down. We're at a Halloween party in Brooklyn. And he lived in L.A. at the time. And he sat my sister down. He's like, listen. He's like, I don't really understand what's going on with your sister, because it's like she acts like she wants to marry me. And then the minute that I bring it up, she like runs like the wind. And what is happening? And Felicia was like, listen, let me talk to her because she's absolutely crazy. She's a crazy person. And he's like, yeah, she is crazy. And I just don't – I just really don't know what she wants. And he had a serious talk with my sister. Like, not funny. So then she, like, confronted me, and she's like, look, you are going to lose the most – the best guy that I have met for you. He's an adult. He's normal. He's not going to break your heart. Like, she gave me a big lecture and said, you know, what are you afraid of? And I was like, I'm afraid of getting steamrolled. He is a steamroller. And I'm a steamroller, and I'm afraid that this steamroller is going to steamroll this steamroller.
Mm-hmm. Again, so, it's that fear of getting sort of subsumed into his whole being and his whole career and all that, right?
He was way ahead of me. Mm-hmm. Like, his thing was already – his ship was sailing. Do you know what I mean? It was already in motion, and I was, like, still building my ship. So I felt like if I get married to this guy, it's going to be the end of my life. And when I actually talked to a therapist about it, I'm like, I don't know why I'm so scared of this guy. And she told me to close my eyes. And she said, picture yourself in 5 years, in 10 years. Is Jim there? And I was like, yeah, he is there. He really is there. Like, I love him. And I will have, no matter what happens to him or to me, I will enjoy my life if I'm with this guy. Mm-hmm. And so it should have occurred to me 2 years earlier than that. But it was like someone finally had to be like, look, you got to see what you have. You have to see what you have. Like, don't just keep, because if you keep waiting for the perfect man to come along, you're going to be in the grave waiting for the perfect man.
Well, it seems to have worked out well. We mentioned a moment ago what a great working relationship you two have and how you worked together on the Jim Gaffigan show for TV Land. I have to say, I was such a huge fan of that show. There just aren't enough sitcoms these days that have that kind of warmth and heart in addition to all the comedy. I was really sad to see the show end, and I kind of assumed that it had just not been renewed by TV Land, but I guess you say in the book that wasn't really the case. It sounds like you guys had a more personal reason for ending the show.
Yeah, it was, you know, about to be the time of the, you know, it happens in the summer, right? Mm-hmm. So the renewals happen in the summer, and, you know, everyone waits to find out if their show's renewed or whatever. And we were in a situation where we had the second season, which, by the way, was some of the most fun artistically I've ever had. And it was an amazing, you know, artistic collaboration between Jim and I and creative freedom. It was just really great. But the balance was way off because we have five kids. And, you know, things happen with kids. They get sick or someone, you know, teacher thinks they might have, like, dyslexia. Like, things happen. And you're like, what? I'm sorry, I can't leave the set. And it was both of us, both executive producing, him in every scene almost, me behind the camera for everything. Getting calls from the school about a kid having like strep throat and having to send an assistant to the doctor with the kid because I couldn't leave the set. And, you know, I do believe that it's possible to do it all. And I think that, you know, women always try to do it all, you know, and I think it is possible to do it all. I just don't recommend it because it's not good for you. It's just not good for your, to split, you know, to be the jack of all trades. And the thing is that both of us, one, when you're in a partnership, like the way that we've made five kids work is that, you know, at a certain point, Jim went on the road and I stayed home with the kids because I couldn't bring a newborn baby and a toddler to the dirty green rooms of the improvs across the country. So, you know, you make sacrifices for each other. And sure. When we were on the set, there was no other parent. There's not a number three parent. It wasn't like Big Love where Jim could just take another wife and, you know.
Right.
So, so we were really in a crisis situation. And Jim said, I think that we should just be happy with what we've done. Mm-hmm. We should go to the next step. And we have to get, you know, the network executives on the phone before they renew us, you know, because it's like, you know, it was a hard show. It was an expensive show. It was, mm-hmm. you know, it was like, it wasn't like they were like down on their knees, like begging us to do, you know what I mean? Like it wasn't canceled or anything like that, but it was going to be renewed. There's no doubt in my mind it was going to be renewed because.
Yeah, it was a great show.
It was a critically acclaimed show and like people loved it. And people in New York, you know, we used New York was a character on that show.
Right. And it must have been a weird experience for you guys to be spending so much time with your TV family that is so closely based on your real family instead of spending that much time with your actual real family.
Yes, that's exactly the conversation we had. And then also the material for the show was based on our observational comedy about our life with our children.
Right, and you weren't at home observing as much.
We're going to run out of material when we're not spending time with our children.
Right.
Like, we're going to call our nanny and be like, anything funny happened today?
Well, is it fair to say that if you had done a third season, you might not be around today? Because who knows if you would have been able to actually pause and find out about this pear-shaped tumor that you ended up having.
In my heart of hearts, I absolutely believe that there is no answer other than I would not be here talking to you today.
Really?
Because even in the last season two, the last episode, like the last week of filming, not post, but like the last week of actually being on the set, I sprained my foot and it was really swollen and really painful. And all I did was ask a PA to go to the props department and get me a set of crutches. I was like, I can't go to the doctor. If it starts to turn like green, I'll, you know, maybe have call someone in. But it was like that level of, you know, working 80 hours a week. You know, it was like very intense, you know, and also my kids did come to the set. Like we would have the babysitters like pick them up at school and come to the set. Cause I'm like, if they don't come to the set to have dinner with us, I'm not going to see my kids today. Because when I left, they were asleep. And when I get home, they're going to be asleep. And they're not going to remember me. So we did see our kids, but it just wasn't engaging with them.
Yeah, I imagine that it must be difficult, too, because here you are, you're just kind of consumed with just the mechanics of trying to keep everyone on track and on schedule with five kids and a husband. That I imagine that it's possible that you can sort of become blind to the meaningful everyday things and those little moments of personal connection because you're just trying to keep the ship going.
Yeah, well, that's what I learned when I moved my office home because we didn't stop working. Like we started working on a comedy special right away. So I was still, you know, very busy and, you know, with the five kids. And I think that I was like, I'm going to spend more time with my kids. And I kind of made a list of how I felt that I should spend time with my kids. But it wasn't until my my life was interrupted by this brain tumor, and I had a lot of time to like lie in the ICU and stare at the ceiling and think about my life and not be able to eat or talk or breathe on my own and be pretty immobile, is that I had this time to like go into this like inner monastery really and like look at my life and realize that all I had done by leaving the show to spend more time with my kids was just become, instead of the showrunner of the Jim Gaffigan show, I became the house runner of the Jim Gaffigan household. So, you know, I treated like my life as if it were a production. I was like, okay, you know, when people had to get like new clothes for school, I'm like, okay, it's a wardrobe fitting. You know, I mean, I'm being funny now, but it's like I was more caught up in the production of the family than those little moments in between all the noise where you, when it's taken away from you, you realize that that's what the important things are. You don't remember the time that, you know, someone dropped by and your house was spotless and they're like, wow, I can't believe you have five kids. You remember the times where, you know, there's, you find like homemade slime stuck to the bottom of your kitchen table. And that's like really the big picture is is the beauty of having a big family.
I mean, this sounds like this tumor really was a wake-up call for you. And I'm curious, how did you find out that you had this massive tumor at the base of your brain?
Well, it wasn't like a normal, like, point A to point B, like, oh, I went right into the brain surgeon office. I was at a pediatric well-child visit with all five of my kids in this little exam room, which is kind of a comical situation. And like once a year, you have to get all these forms signed off for school and camp and all this stuff. So I have like papers and forms and kids and all this stuff. And I have this really great, amazing family practitioner who's actually originally from Canada. And I kind of attribute her kind of medical style to like this sort of, you know, home visit type of like doctor. You just feel like you're in, you know, you're in her house. So I was talking about, she was making a comment about how big the kids were getting and how, you know, she's going to have to get a bigger office to get them all in there or whatever. And I made a comment about how the last time we were all in there, we all, I got them all flu shots, but they all got the flu anyway. And I got the flu too. And then she said something and it was like her mouth was moving, but like the sounds weren't coming out of her mouth. So I was like, well, that was weird. And then I turned my head towards her with my right ear towards her mouth. And I said, can you say that again? And she goes, is something wrong with your ear? And I'm like, yeah, I sometimes I can't hear out of it. It like comes and goes. I, you know, I don't really know what's going on. And she's like, well, she said, how long has that been happening? And I'm like, I don't know, a few years. I don't know. She was like, what do you mean a few? You didn't come in? And I said, well, I'm busy. I don't, you know, I don't take care of myself. I have a lot of other people to worry about. So she looked at my ear and she's like, it looks fine to me. She's like, I'm going to write you a referral to an ENT. So I'm like, oh, another appointment. Okay. And she's like, I want you to follow up. Mothers have to take care of themselves. This, like, always am saying this, that you have to put your own oxygen mask on before you can give the oxygen to the other kids. Yeah. I'm like, oh, okay. All right. So I go to the ENT. He doesn't see anything wrong with my ear. Gives me a, you know, tells me to get Flonase and listen to a, you know, an audio program to like strengthen my like lazy ear. So I go back in a month. I'm like, yeah, it's still kind of going in and out. I can't really hear. So he's like, well, you know, it's sometimes there's like a one in like 10 million chance that someone has like a neuroma on their, you know, it could be, it's like, it's something that occurs sometimes that, but we can't see it from the outside. So you have to get an MRI. I'm like, oh, another appointment. So eventually I go and I get the MRI. And then when I got out of the MRI, the technician looked at me like I was about to die. And I know they're not supposed to say anything, but I could tell that his demeanor changed so dramatically when I came out. And I wasn't even thinking. I was like ticking off the to-do list. Like I wasn't thinking like, you know, there's going to be another follow-up after this. I was like, I'm doing what, you know, Dr. Hobbs told me to go to the doctor, so that's what I'm doing. So check. And I saw the look in his eyes, like he's, you know, it was different. And I was like, well, that was really weird. And I went out to the waiting room and I was like, okay, do I need to like copay or what's happening? And they're just like, sit down, your doctor's going to call you. And I'm like, what? Wait, because I was at a radiology center. I wasn't in a hospital. So I sat there for like 45 minutes and I was like, wait a minute, my doctor's not going to call me. That's not why. So I went up to the receptionist and I said, you know, I wasn't told to wait here by my doctor. Like, I think there must be some kind of mistake. So eventually I just left because I was like, but I had this weird, creepy feeling like something was wrong. So I went back to the office and Jim and I were working on something as usual. And I said, you know, I have this really creepy feeling. Like, and he was like, you got an MRI for what? I'm like, oh, it's a long story. I didn't even tell him that I had an MRI. So about an hour later, my ENT calls me and is like, hi. You know, funny thing is that the MRI revealed that you have a mass in your brain. And so it's not your ear. So I'm going to just refer you to a neurosurgeon. And I was like, what? And he was like, yeah, this is kind of outside of my wheelhouse. So I'm going to recommend some really great people to you. But I mean, at this point, it's not your ear anymore. And I said, neurosurgeon. I was like, why a neurosurgeon? He goes, well, you know, normally I would say neurologist, but I mean, I just think the neurologist will just refer you to a neurosurgeon. And I was like, well, what is the neurosurgeon going to do about this mass in my brain? He's like, well, I could imagine that they would probably resect it. And I said, well, what does resect mean? And he said, remove. And I said, but isn't it in my brain? And he's like, well, you know, why don't you just make the appointment? And you know, sometimes these things are, you know, not as bad as it seems. Like, people have things. And I was like, okay. And like, that's how I found out I had a mass in my brain. I didn't hear tumor. I didn't see it. I didn't know. And the next like 24 hours was basically spent, like, this is like kind of the mystery and the suspense in the book.
Yeah.
And the adventure.
Yeah.
Is that what was that period of time like for me when I was trying to advocate for myself and figure out what was going on with what was in my brain and how I was going to deal with it?
Yeah. And it happened so quickly. I mean, basically from finding out about the tumor to going into surgery, it was over like a long holiday weekend, Easter weekend, right?
That's right. That's right.
Not a lot of time to prepare.
I had the MRI on Tuesday. Wednesday was kind of like me looking for someone to like help me. Thursday, I found the neurosurgeon. Friday was scanning. Saturday and Sunday were Easter weekend. It was off. When it was like the best Easter weekend I ever had in my life with my family. And then I went into the hospital on Monday and had brain surgery.
Wow. And when you woke up from surgery, it seemed like everything went well. You were talking and you were lucid and so forth. And then you pass out. Next thing you know, you wake up in the ICU. What went wrong there?
Well, the area where like you said, the surgery couldn't have been more successful. They saved all my nerves, which was like, you know, there were a lot of them were on the chopping block. Facial nerve was, you know, in jeopardy. You know, there was a lot of talk about what kind of person I would be when I woke up and what kind of how I would be able to function. And when I woke up, everyone was extremely happy about the way the surgery went. And I, you know, was thrilled. And I passed out because I was still drugged. You know, I couldn't stay awake. And somehow within that sleep that I had, because of where the tumor sat on my cranial nerves, my speech and my swallow function got all mixed up. And I breathed in my saliva, basically, is what happened. I aspirated, and my lungs filled up, and I developed bilateral pneumonia, which was extremely dangerous and severe. And I woke up, and I was on breathing tubes and lots of tubes coming out of me, and people were very worried. And I, you know, it was very difficult for me to breathe. even with the intubation. And I had a high fever. It was bad.
Wow. And what was the hardest part about being in the ICU?
I think the utter deprivation, the not eating, drinking, seeing my children. It was, you know, it was a, I mean, I didn't really feel like a human being. You know, it was like you sleep for like 5 minutes at a time. And then, you know, I would wake up and think it was the next day. And it was like 10 minutes later. And it just, it seemed like every day was like 5 years. It was a very, very challenging experience for me to be in that, to be in the ICU with the pneumonia.
Mm-hmm. You know, Jim refers to you as the Shiite Catholic, and I know your faith is very important to you. And you say that God spoke to you while you were in the ICU. What did he or she say to you?
Very politically correct of you. Yes. I do, and you know, that reminds me, I do refer to God as he in my book, and I never thought of it that way because I mean, it's like I don't really think of God as like a man with a beard and the way that people, it's just like this all-encompassing force.
Right. Well, this is the post-Time's Up God.
Yes. And I went in that situation when I was at my darkest hour, as they say, I went to a really, really bad place, you know, where I never understood when people were like, oh, just pull the plug on me. But it's like I almost understood that.
Really?
You know, it was like I can't imagine living my life like this. You know, because I couldn't, like, talk about, like, you know, separation of families, right? It's a real thing. It's like when you don't see your kid. I mean, if you're used to seeing and having, you know, loving relationships with people, and then you're just like this, you know, fragile, like, shell, it was just day after day of, like, suffering, and I wasn't really prepared to mentally handle it because there was no reprieve for a while. And I went to God in my mind and I was like, why? I'm like, just let me just have one more chance. I started to look at my life and like all the, you know, things that I regret about not, you know, taking those little moments that I'm talking about, like those moments to like stop and smell the flowers. And I mean, not to be cliche, but that literally I was like, why don't I stop and smell the flowers? And God was very positive and dragged me out of the darkness and said, yeah, you're going to get through this, but let's, you know, I'm going to give you some commandments. Mm-hmm. You know, I really felt like I had my own personal commandments.
Really?
I had, like, the God was like, listen, you need to worry about yourself and how you conduct yourself and stop worrying about controlling everyone else. Let go of your ego.
Yeah.
You're never going to be perfect. Your kids are going to be fine without you micromanaging them. You know, it was like a very clear perspective of my life. And I just knew that I was going to get through it and I was going to come out and I was going to be a different person.
Yeah.
And I knew that I was still going to be crazy type A genie and still be, you know, need to work all the time and stuff like that. But I was not going to let that work run me.
When you were living through all of this and just sitting there in the ICU, were you already thinking about writing about it?
I think that one of the ways that I coped during the time, just like if anyone who was a musician or a painter would express their experience was through, you know, their art. Mm-hmm. I had to, you know, take time when I was in the hospital and recovering to ask people to write things down because I just, like, things would occur to me and I was like, I'm going to forget this. I don't know if I'm going to be alive tomorrow. Mm-hmm. So when I was putting together the chronology as I was explaining before of like, what exactly happened? How did this happen? Where did I first start getting the symptoms? What about who I was before influenced the way that I reacted to this? And actually putting together in the form of a story to share. I had all these notes and drips and drabs and poems and writings and lists and things that actually were being produced by me while I was really on death's door. So I had the opportunity to interview the sick me, which was a really neat thing.
One thing that you say in here is that it was a little bit like a Freaky Friday role reversal for you and Jim, because, you know, as you said, you had been the person who kept the family running for so long. Was it a revelation to see that, you know, Jim's got this? He can step up when he needs to step up and get the kids dressed into school and keep up with homework and all the stuff that had sort of been in your wheelhouse up to then?
Oh, it was like seeing somebody with new eyes. And it wasn't only that, because, you know, caregiving and taking care of kids and getting everyone dressed and brushing teeth and, you know, all that kind of stuff is really not in Jim's wheelhouse. And it might have been a little bit messier. The house was, you know, it wasn't, you know, Jeannie Gaffigan style parenting, but it was fine. He did it fine.
Now, they say that laughter is the best medicine, and Jim kind of took it upon himself to be your personal court jester when you were finally able to move back in for home care. How important was having a sense of humor to your recovery?
Having somebody funny to help me along with that recovery was like, I mean, there's nothing like the endorphins of, you know, the joy it produces. And if you have someone that can actually produce joy, it's healing. It helped me heal. And I really understood, and talk about faith, I really understood why God designed Jim and I to become a couple.
Really?
And it was so obvious to me that it was like, we're perfect for each other.
Mm-hmm.
And if I didn't have Jim during this crisis, like, I don't know if I would have been able to heal so well.
Yeah.
Because he got me through some of the most depressing times with his comedy and his perspective and his ability to look at the world differently.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm grateful every day that if life was going to give me pears, that I had all these people to help me make pear aid.
Yeah. And Jim had really kind of dropped everything to deal with this and stepped up to the plate. How did you know when it was finally time for Jim to start touring again?
You know, I felt like I had everything sort of covered. My brother and his wife moved into our old two-bedroom apartment of Dennis Fat fame and of the Jim Gaffigan Show fame, which we had moved to a bigger place. But I couldn't let go of that apartment, so I rented it out. And when I got sick, I had all these family members on couches, and we already are, you know, kind of bursting at the seams in my new apartment. And it was just so happened that apartment was between leases. It was vacant. And obviously I was not, you know, in any position to like be a realtor for that apartment. And so I asked my brother and sister-in-law, because their lease was up. It was just like the stars were perfect to move into that, to rent from us, because it's like they were neighbors, and I needed kind of like a family, like right down the block, because, you know, if Jim was gone, I needed to be able to know that somebody was there. And we had this neighbor who had keys, who was a nurse, who's a really good friend of ours.
Yeah.
And I felt like I had the community support system, so Jim didn't have to be my like primary caregiver, head nurse and comedy concierge anymore.
Before we go, I just have to ask, where are you with your recovery at this point?
I mean, I cannot complain. I still get 6-month head and neck MRIs for to monitor any tumor regrowth.
Mm-hmm.
It was benign. So that is a major blessing that it, you know, it's a benign tumor. And any regrowth will be able to be dealt with radiation therapy. Right. So there's no more brain surgery in my future. And also I'm being closely monitored for any other, like I had some residual damage to my lungs because I had really intense strep pneumonia. But what that has done is I get CT scans of the chest every 6 months, which, I mean, pretty much everyone should do because you never know what's going to happen. So I'm totally covered there. And I'm still in speech and swallow therapy, and I have one paralyzed vocal cord, but I'm getting some – I've had one follow-up surgery on my vocal cords, and I'm probably going to get another one in a month or so. And it's outpatient, and, you know, I'm feeling great. I can't complain, and I'm, you know, wrote a book, and when life gives you pears.
Well, it sounds like things are looking up, and I definitely wish you and your family all the very best, Jeannie. Again, Jeannie Gaffigan's memoir is called When Life Gives You Pears, The Healing Power of Family, Faith, and Funny People. Jeannie Gaffigan, it's been such a pleasure. Take care and say hi to Jim.
Okay.
Thanks.
I will. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks again to Jeannie Gaffigan for coming on the show. Order When Life Gives You Pears, The Healing Power of Family, Faith, and Funny People on Amazon, Audible, or wherever books are sold. And follow Jeannie on Twitter at Jeannie Gaffigan. If you enjoyed today's podcast, be sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and rate and review us while you're there. 5-star ratings and detailed reviews are one of the best ways for new listeners to discover the show. You can also follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at KickAssNewsPod and recommend us to your friends on your social media. For more fun stuff, visit kickassnews.com, and I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.